Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
And I'm a professor of ophthalmology from University of California, San Francisco.
Gary Aguilar. Hey, Gary.
Hey. Hey, Fred. Actually, Fred, you and I are going to listen to Gary Aguilar, Dr. Aguilar, because 2 years ago, I interviewed him. In fact, we debated. And I wanted to debate. He's a professor of ophthalmology, so he's an expert on the eye.
Expert on the eye.
So yeah. That's what I wanted. He's an atheist also, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, how often do you get an expert on the eye, atheist, who thinks that the eye had no designer, no creator?
Yeah.
What an opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the eye is so incredibly complex, and it's always been one of the centerpieces of the creation evolution debate, right?
Yeah.
Starting with Darwin.
Yeah, Darwin, although he believed that the eye evolved, he said he freely admits it seems absurd in the highest degree to claim that the eye could have evolved.
Yeah,
but he believes it did.
By slight modifications over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the arguments I use later in the interview/debate with Dr. Aguilar is, if it has to go slight modifications, well, then how do you get from monochromatic to dichromatic? That's like going from a black and white TV to a color TV. How do you do that? By little gradations.
Yeah. And then, hey, I don't think this came up in the interview, but the trochlea challenge. We should mention that at some point.
Okay.
Too.
Yeah. We'll do that.
That's one of my favorites.
Fred, and one of my favorites is when we say, stop the tape. So could we do that? When Dr. Aguilar was on the show, it went for about an hour and a half, and he really would take so many tangents. I mean, marijuana legalization, that came up so many times.
The Kennedy
assassination, the Crusades. Mm-hmm. So he just wanted to take pot shots at Christians, whichever possible extraneous way he could. But what we've done here is we've excerpted about 40 minutes worth of discussion on the evolution of the eye. So you'll hear stop the tape here and there. But if you want to hear the whole thing, it's right on our website. So yeah. You could hear the hour and a half. It's like listening to Aaron Roth for an hour and a half.
Yeah, going off on tangents.
It's a little bit painful. Well, Gary had suggested, he contacted me to be on the show. And he's a clinical professor. He teaches surgery, eye surgery, of ophthalmology in San Francisco. So he suggested that I read this book written by an associate, a colleague of his at the University of California, Irvine, titled Evolution's Witness, How Eyes Evolved.
And you bought the book.
I bought the book, got the book. As soon as UPS delivered it, I wrote a prediction. In fact, Fred.
Well, you had witnesses there, right?
Yeah, here's the book.
I see the book.
So UPS delivers it. Could you take this book?
I will take the book.
And read the prediction I wrote inside the front cover.
Okay, here it is. Prediction. Very little of this book will be about how eyes evolve.
Yeah, right. So Gary described it as a tour de force showing how eyes evolved. Fred, the book is not about how eyes evolved. It's a beautiful anatomy book. It has wonderful diagrams and photographs of eyes and vision systems and all different kinds of creatures. I mean, praise the Lord.
Well, what percentage is it about evolution of the eye, would you say?
Not even 1%.
Less than 1%.
The vast majority of what you would have to cover to talk about how eyes evolved, like how it could all start with in the beginning, is just omitted from the book. It's an anatomy book with an evolutionary gloss, which we're used to.
Yeah.
Right? But before we hear Dr. Aguilar, Fred, we should let the audience know that we're going to be speaking in Denver soon, right?
Yeah. Friday, October 10th, it's going to be a live Real Science Radio. And man, I can't wait for this. It's going to be Evidences Against the Big Bang.
Oh.
It's one of our list shows. You know, the list shows are
real popular.
People really like them.
If you Google Evidence Against the Big Bang, we're on the first page out of so many million.
Yeah. Yep. Come on out to Denver. It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
And it's youngearth.org if you want to know how to get there.
It'll be so much fun. And then the next night in Denver, you know that we're on the ballot, Fred, right? With our pro-life personhood amendment, the Brady Amendment 67 in Colorado. Well, there's going to be a concert, Be a Voice for Brady concert at Church in the City, downtown Denver, in NBC's TV show, The Voice. Four of the singers from 2014, The Voice, are coming to Denver to sing at our Be a Voice for Brady benefit
that's
concert.
That's going to be a fantastic concert.
Isn't that exciting? That's just going to be so thrilling. And then one more thing, Fred, the sales of our global flood video and the hydroplane theory, the sales are going great. In fact, right before the show, our office manager gave me these few orders. One, Ben L. from Winneconne, Wisconsin, ordered the flood video. And here we have from Hobbs, New Mexico, Jimmy D. ordered the flood video. And how about this one from London in the UK? 2 weeks ago, ordered the flood video, and today donated toward our telethon to stay on the air for another year, $5,000 toward the telethon.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
It's stunning. We are now over $15,000 toward our $25,000 goal.
Oh, that's great. Now, you know, this is a shameless plug for your video, but I watched it again because, I thought it was great that you let me use your slides because I presented this topic to a church on the Eastern Plains in Hudson, Colorado.
Yeah, you presented the hydroplane theory, the global flood.
Oh, man. So, you know, I watched the video again. It was really kind of, honestly, the third time I watched it. It gets better every time. And I know, it sounds biased. It's true. And, you know, like you said, one of the things that I take away from the video, there's so much great content in there. But all these scientists are doing the work for Walt Brown. He makes these predictions, and you can see it. It's in the major news. It's in the major science journals of the things that he predicted with his hydroplane theory that are coming about years after he made the prediction.
Yeah.
And it fits like a glove. And everything fits
then
so
Genesis,
well.
You could understand Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, when God created the firmament and the waters above and below. And then in the flood chapters, where the water came from and where the water went.
Yeah, in a real respectful way of dealing with the other popular theories among,
like,
you
the
know,
vapor
like,
canopy
and the catastrophic plate tectonics. You know, that's still, for whatever reason, still in vogue. I don't think it will be much longer after this video. Seriously, after maybe a year or two. I don't know how long it'll take, but that's got to start eroding. And I liked, you know, how Google shows that the hydroplate theory is really double now the search of catastrophic plate tectonics.
Yeah. So
popular. You've got a really good presentation on what those theories teach and what's wrong with
them. Yeah. In other words, where's the whole creation movement? Where has it been and where is it at and where is it headed regarding the global flood and how God created on days two and day three? What was going on back then?
Yeah. And I used to have a slide that said day two was atmosphere. So that slide's long gone.
Long gone.
It was the crust of the earth that was created on day two.
The firmament. The crust of the earth.
Yep.
Praise the Lord.
Yeah, great video. Highly recommend it.
Oh, thank you so much, Fred. So now, Fred, University of California Professor Gary Aguilar versus Real Science Radio on the evolution of the eye. Dr. Aguilar, welcome to Real Science Friday. It's been 6 months. Do you still think this book was a tour de force?
Hi. Thank you very much, Bob, for having me on the
program.
You're
welcome. Thank you.
And, you know, again, the issue behind the book, I've spoken, of course, to Ivan Schwab. He thinks that it's sort of silly. He says the arguments against evolution reflect generally a very poor understanding of evolutionary theory in a general kind of way, and also the fact that, and this is from private conversations with him and from other things as well, that there have been a number of, quote, visual evolutions, unquote, in lower animals and from insects to waterborne animals and that sort of thing, and that there are even one-celled animals that develop certain photopigments that allow them to be drawn toward light.
Right.
So the clear advantage in terms of survival of having light-perceptive systems is tremendous. So there are clear advantages to perceptive systems.
Oh, absolutely.
Such that as you move up through the scale, and there are aspects of the human eye, for example, the nictitating membrane in lower animals is present in the plica semilunaris, which has no function in humans, none whatsoever.
Well, wait, stop the tape. Stop the tape. Wait a minute.
Fred, this is a fun one, right?
Oh, yeah.
Now, we're going to talk about this for a bit, but I had not heard this when we did this 2 years ago. What I did then was went online to the ultimate authority in ophthalmology. It is called Duane's Foundation of Clinical Ophthalmology, Volume 2, Chapter 2. I linked to it online. And this is what they say about the plica semilunaris and the nictitating membrane.
Say that 100 times real fast.
Yeah, right. I had a hard time following even what the words were when he first said it. But they say this explicitly, that the plica semilunaris functions during movement of the eye to help maintain tear drainage and to permit greater rotation of the eyeball, for without the plica, the membrane called the conjunctiva, you know, people sometimes get conjunctivitis, the conjunctiva would attach directly to the eyeball, restricting movement.
Restricting movement of the eyeball.
Yes. So you have helping to maintain tear drainage. It's in the corner of the eye there. So, Fred, that's one example. We're going to see this over and over where the evolutionist, who should be an expert, is decades behind the science.
Yeah, decades behind. And I mean, here there's actually two functions, right? It's the tear drainage and movement of the eyeball. I mean,
right. And while creation scientists are very responsible and highly authoritative, this comes from the world's leading secular source on ophthalmology.
Yeah. Yeah, without that, then those Alfred Hitchcock movies with the eyeballs in the picture following people
exactly.
couldn't happen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there we go. So people will notice this trend. Dr. Aguilar, the evolutionist, is decades or even centuries behind on the science.
Yep.
And the creationist Bible thumpers are current on the science. And also what we've already heard, that Dr. Aguilar says that, well, Bob, don't you know that vision helps survival?
Of course.
But that doesn't say whether it was designed or evolved.
Exactly.
It just says it helps survival. He can't distinguish between those two claims.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand that because something helps survival, like a parachute jumping out of an airplane, that helps survival. That doesn't tell you how the parachute came into existence.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll see these trends as we continue.
Yeah, and didn't he write later on after the interview, he wrote you and admitted that, hey, this thing actually does have a function.
Yeah, oops. That's right. In the next year, he emailed, because we corresponded a bit afterward, and he said, let me acknowledge that the plica semilunaris is considered to have some function.
Yeah. So hopefully he won't use that lame argument again.
Maybe not. We predicted Richard Dawkins is never again going to say that the eye was wired backwards.
Yeah.
We'll find out if that's true or not.
Yeah.
Because of all the evidence that it's wired optimally. Okay, let's continue.
Predecessors to humans used nictitating membranes, and you can see them sometimes when a dog blinks his eye. There is a membrane that will sometimes cover back and forth across the eye.
Dr. Aguilar, could you repeat that? What is it that has no function whatsoever?
The plica, P-L-I-C-A, semilunaris.
I appreciate you being a teacher, because you could tell us these things. Plica,
The irony of the situation is that there are very well developed, as was pointed out not only by Ivan Schwab and other people, there are multiple different lines of evolution in different animals to different types of eyes.
Yeah, the claim is that it's convergent, that eyes evolved a number of different times. Back in the 1990s, Eugenie Scott said to me something similar to what you just said. Only she was talking about junk DNA. She said that the vast majority of our DNA was junk. It had no function. And I said, Eugenie, don't you think it's too early? And she said, no, we affirmatively know it has no function. And so I wrote down the date, the time. In fact, we still sell the DVD. This was on a national TV show, me and Eugenie debating for an hour. And fast forward to September 2012, I don't know if you've noticed the journal Nature just came out with a landmark study by 440 scientists, 32 labs. They said, so far, we've identified function in 80% of the human genome.
Stop the tape, stop the tape. So, Fred, the idea that Dr. Aguilar said that vision may have evolved many times, mm-hmm. that's actually debated by evolutionists. Some say dozens of times or even scores of times vision evolved independently.
Yeah. Convergent evolution, as you mentioned. And here's the key. It evolved independently of the other case where an eye is evolving. So imagine how complex the eye is, and it has to evolve. I know at one time they were saying 40 separate times.
40
separate different lines of organisms that, you know, evolving an eye that has no idea about this other organism. There's no common ancestry helping push it along. It's all happening by mistakes in the DNA and some kind of blind, no pun intended, selection process.
Fred,
happening independently. It's crazy. That's incredible faith.
And when you compare echolocation, which is like a tracking kind of system,
between whales and bats, and the programming and the DNA is almost identical. And so the odds of that are bazillions to bazillions to one.
Bats and whales have a very recent common ancestor,
right? Well,
really goofy looking creature,
this
but you know.
Alleged expert on eye evolution, Dr. Fernald, who is written in the preface of this book by Ivan Schwab, Aguilar's colleague. He has an article out in a journal, Behavior and Evolution, and it's on the evolution of eyes. And Fernald says that, in fact, you know, whether eyes evolved once or many times is argued. But on page 145 of his book, he lists evolutionists who think, like you said, 40 times,
mm-hmm.
50 times, 65 times, separate times eyes evolved. And he says the mysteries involved with eye evolution are so significant that some evolutionists think it happened over and over and over, like it happens every other day.
Yeah.
And it's so wildly complicated.
Well, evolution is, in the end, is just magic. I mean, they don't really, you know, it's just,
yeah,
it's a fairy tale for grown-ups.
So back to Aguilar. Because this book, when I got it on March 31st, I wrote something on the title page, and I asked people who were around me to sign it as witnesses. And here's what I wrote. Prediction. Very little of this book will be about how eyes evolved. I mean, it's titled How Eyes Evolved, Evolution's Witness, How Eyes Evolved. And I assert that more than 99% of this book has nothing to do with how eyes evolved. This is an anatomy book that does a wonderful job telling us how eyes function, and it has an evolutionary gloss. It just has these assumptions, and I could give you examples of entire missing chapters. You know, like opsin, the protein in photoreceptor cells that convert photons to electrical chemical signals. You would think maybe the first chapter after the intro would be how opsin evolved, because that is an extraordinary challenge to explain theoretically how this molecule of, you know, invertebrates versus vertebrates, 250 to 350 amino acids, how they came together, how they folded correctly, how they produced an output. I just been hit by a photon. How the output gets sent not to the chin, but to the brain. That is a massive part of the problem. If you're going to explain how eyes evolved, you skip. It's like Darwin skipped life. He did Origin of Species, only he didn't describe how a species originated. He sort of cheated. He started with life.
Well, now, this is your view, Bob. I mean, yeah, let's just say this is the view of a creationist fundamentalist Christian. Okay, this is not what anyone who is an evolutionary biologist would argue, but you're welcome to your opinion. Okay, so fine. It is your opinion that he should have talked about something he didn't talk about. Okay,
yeah.
So this is a classic example of blaming people for arguments that they don't make and faulting them for arguments
Well, he does.
They don't make.
He has a sidebar.
Stop tape. Stop the tape.
So, yeah, Fred, opsin. It's
like, yeah, we got to talk about opsin.
Where's the chapter? How eyes evolved.
Yeah, that would be pretty important. I mean, this is a very specialized nanomachine. It's a protein that in vertebrates has 150 amino acids.
So that means 150 letters of coding for that protein.
Yeah, and there's a very sophisticated mechanism to fold all these amino acids into a protein. I mean, it's amazing. And if any of that folding messes up, it gets thrown out.
It's going to be
there's
broken.
There's an incredible error correction system. And then for invertebrates, there's 250 of these amino acids that have to be in the right sequence. And again, all these letters in the right place, folded properly. Again, the folding mechanism is amazingly complex.
That you need a nanomachine, which is very specialized. Like I think I mentioned, it responds to a single photon, right? You
yep.
light a match and there's what, trillions of photons coming out every microsecond. So many photons.
Yeah.
Imagine one photon. When he's going to say later that the eye is poorly designed, it's wired backwards like Richard Dawkins, and everybody says Michael Shermer. Fred, the eye has a 10 billion to 1 dynamic range. That is
10
so
billion
much,
to 1.
10 billion to 1. You could go from one photon to a blazing bright sunny day.
Wow. You know, my wife loves to take pictures. We got her a really nice camera because she's like, vacations is like, it's more picture taking than it is enjoying the vacation. Sorry, honey. Hope you don't hear that. But is her camera more sophisticated, more complex than the eye?
Oh.
Does it have that kind of dynamic ratio? I don't think so.
No, the human eye to a camera we make is almost
like a space shuttle to a burp.
Yeah.
It's just so rudimentary compared to the human eye. So that kind of dynamic range, 10 billion to one, where you could sense a single photon.
A single photon.
And so that machine, that little nano machine, and that's a pretty good term for it, only it's better than a machine, you know. But that little machine, the parts have to be lined up in just the right way. So think of 150 parts, and then they have to be folded, like when you buy a present for your kid for Christmas, an assembly required, and you want to go nuts.
Yeah.
Because there's like 82 parts.
And again, it's a real complex folding mechanism.
Oh, to fold those 150 amino acids in the right way.
And so it's got to be done in the ribosome and all these other wildly complex things.
And even in invertebrates without a backbone, it's even way more complex.
Yeah.
To skip that, he has in his book, How Eyes Evolved, Ivan Schwab, he's professor of ophthalmology at UC Irvine. And he has a sidebar on it. A sidebar. It's this unfathomable problem of how to evolve this nano machine.
Yep.
So that it would register an incoming photon and it would send an output of some kind of an electrochemical signal. He pretty much just skips it.
Yeah. Like you said, the chapter's missing. And that would be an important chapter, right? If you're going to defend the evolution of the eye. I mean, this is a pretty important little machine.
It should be right after the introduction.
Yeah, it should
be. That's the first
chapter. Critical.
And then these other, that I'll be describing, these other fundamental chapters, they're just missing.
Yeah.
Which cracks me up. It's like introduction to architecture 101 and nothing to do with trusses or spans or bridges or material strengths, nothing.
Yeah, introduction to being a car mechanic, and there's nothing in there about the engine.
You're right.
You know?
Exactly. So let's continue.
Let's get to the issues that have to do with the fact that, if you go through strata, geologic strata, the further back you go geologically, the more primitive the animals are, and at some point in time, you can tell, even from the hard data that's in rock layers and that sort of stuff, that animals at that point, though much more primitive than what we see on the Earth today, did have things that looked like eyes.
Can we stop the tape here? I got to respond to this.
Yeah.
You know, that's an old canard by evolutionists that things were, more primitive as you go back in time into the fossil record. That couldn't be farther from the truth. And we can quote leading evolutionists who say that idea of simple to complex is just completely wrong. And so if we can get evolutionists to admit that, why do they still use that as an argument?
Could I have that book back? How Eyes Evolved, Past That Back? Because Ivan Schwab himself, Fred, talks about trilobite eyes. And trilobite eyes, and we're going way back like a half a billion years ago. Trilobite eyes are so wildly complex. And when Darwin was writing his theory, he thought that the cell was like a blob of protoplasm, a blob of gelatin or something, like a mushy ping pong ball. Well, now we know that a cell is more complex than the space shuttle.
100 million times over.
Yeah. In fact, the cell is still operational.
Good point.
So, Fred, to say that, they were simple, there is no such thing as a simple organism that has ever been discovered.
Yeah.
They are all wildly, wildly complex. And the more we learn about eyes, even in these allegedly primitive creatures, the more befuddled the evolutionists are to try to justify how all of that information, all that programming, functional information came about.
Yeah, and it's an illusionary marketing term that they use, simple, it's primitive. And so they try to paint this picture supporting their view. They couldn't be farther from the truth. But again, it's like advertising. You show pictures and that's what they're trying to do. It's all an illusion that they appeal to.
All right. So University of California, San Francisco, professor of clinical ophthalmology, Dr. Gary Aguilar.
Available. Insects have different types of eyes that we have, which are in some ways as bewilderingly complex, almost as human eyes are.
Right.
And eagles have eyes that are even more complex.
And vultures are more amazing than eagles.
These are all
Right.
These all gave an evolutionary advantage, which allowed them to compete more successfully. And it's very clear that all of these things went along that way. And you can find their peculiarities in the way eyes are made
Let me give you an example by what you say, right, about trilobites. They're buried deep down in the strata. So we're told they lived 525 million years ago. Yet by Ivan's book here, they had complex compound eyes. And because of what we know today from genetics, that is a wild degree of complexity, incredible sophistication. So the way he describes how this might have happened, he said, well, if you look at certain ancient organisms, like he mentions the sponge, he said, you know, the sponge, they didn't have tissues of muscle or nerves. So he said most metazoans have muscles and nerves, but not the sponge. Well, what's interesting is the sponge genome was just sequenced, and it has the genes for nerves and muscles. And what? In 600 million years without using those functions, it didn't lose those? By evolutionary theory, it should lose that. That should all now be random junk.
If they don't, wait a minute. You don't understand evolutionary theory, Bob. It's clearer. Wait, that's wrong.
Yeah. Well, if you don't, if you have a section of DNA, that's unused.
Before you establish that as fact, which you're asserting that because a gene is there, it should have disappeared if it has no function.
It's called conserved functionality. It's a leading concept in evolution.
If the presence of that gene does not hinder the progress and survival of that,
then
it may sit there generation after generation after generation. As long as it doesn't, it's not.
If it doesn't hinder,
gotten rid of it, and there's no advantage to have gotten rid of it, that's why it's still there.
Well, what's called conserved functionality is if the gene is used, then mutations in it will be eliminated by natural selection.
Not necessarily. The genes are sitting there, and
if
they're not
it's
being
not
used,
used
they're not harming
Gary,
the organism.
If it's
they're
not used,
harming the organism, those genes could just sit there.
Except that natural selection cannot then keep them in their sequence because there's no function. So as there are mutations,
there is no function, but there,
all right, let's skip that topic.
There has to be a selective reason to eliminate, not just, there has to be a selective reason to eliminate.
All right, I'm done. I'm
having those genes, and they weren't advantaged or disadvantaged. They just came along for the ride. All right, so let's establish that it was false to say that they had to have been eliminated.
Stop the tape, stop the tape. Fred, this is so funny, Fred.
First of all, what is evolution?
What is evolution? You sound like Eugenie Scott. Fred, we find this all the time. I spoke recently to a New York Times bestselling scientist. I'm not going to give his name because we're having an ongoing conversation. But we talked about the Big Bang for 2 hours. He simply was unaware of the fundamental scientific claims of the Big Bang, yet he believes in it with all his heart.
He should come to our live Real Science Radio science show for the Young Earth Group, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
Yeah, October 10th, Friday night, 7 o'clock. It'll be fun. But, Fred, this is a professor at University of California, San Francisco. In his specialty, the eye, he believes that the eye evolved. He doesn't understand the basic issues regarding eye evolution, and he doesn't understand Darwinism itself. He doesn't understand that if there are thousands of letters of DNA that are not in use, that there would be nothing to stop them from mutating and changing.
Mm-hmm.
They only would get conserved if they are functional.
That's fundamental
neo-Darwinism. Yeah. And we see this all the time. In this example, that's a fundamental evolution claim that Gary Aguilar is completely unaware of.
Yeah.
What I said is natural selection cannot keep the order unless there's a survival advantage.
Wrong.
That's
wrong.
What Darwinists call conserved functionality. Well, so if there's a chunk of your DNA that has no function, then as mutations occur, they won't be eliminated by natural selection. It's called Darwinism.
You don't know what's going to happen.
It's the modern synthesis.
They have no functionality. They may continue to be preserved.
All right.
And by the way, they may have function that we don't yet know about.
Well, yeah, like your Plica
semilunar. There may be functionality for those genes that we don't know about yet.
Gary,
right?
Your Plica semi, I didn't get the rest of it. Might that have a function?
Plica semilunaris.
Lunaris.
And that's nice. That was a great segue to switch topics here, Bob. I love that.
Well,
I love that. Oh,
there was Gary. There was a list of
looking too good there for you.
There was a list of
so let's change it to the Kennedy assassination.
Almost 100 long in humans.
I'm sorry.
And there was a list of vestigial organs, almost 100 of them in humans,
right.
Like the pituitary gland, like all kinds of organs and glands that we need. They're vital. And
yeah,
millions of people lost their tonsils
like limbs in whales that don't have any function anymore. You know, like what appear to have been in prior generations, millions of years ago, something when whales were, you know, land animals of some sort. They had some kind of an appendage. They
that whole rotocetus.
The
whole rotocetus thing is falling apart.
No advantage to the whale to have that little piece of bone there. But there
Gary, do you know the discoverer of the rotocetus? The scientist, Dr. Philip Gingrich, gave it sort of flippers, and he gave it a fluke tail. And then he has been interviewed. It's on video. I transcribed it. He said, I was wrong. It didn't have flippers. It had legs and feet. It's a land animal. I was wrong to give it a fluke tail. And yet the evolutionists still say it was an ancestor to the whale because it's too big to fail. They had the animal completely wrong, but they cling to, well, it was an ancestor. I'm not saying we used to think this, now we think that. I'm talking about major predictions of evolutionary theory that creationists have said are wrong, and the major predictions then fail, and nobody acknowledges it. They pretend that, we never said that, I never heard that. There were not 10,000 evolutionary scientists who wrote this.
There are people who make misstatements, you
predictions.
Know, in the scientific community, Bob. That's a shock.
The whole community.
Oh, my God. There are
Gary,
people who make mistakes.
It's the whole community,
the
whole.
Listen, I can give you an example. I've done peer review.
100%.
I've done peer review of scientific journals.
Yeah.
And there's stuff in there that I disprove all the time.
Yeah,
that's
of course.
Works,
I'm not
Bob.
Talking about
now,
one scientist
Listen, you're
flubbing.
You're just so happy that you've gotten, you're just so delighted that you've gotten some of these people and you've been able to prove you were right and they were wrong. Oh, Bob, you're just so wonderful.
I'm delighted that the major argument for evolution for 30 years has been proved false. I am delighted.
Oh yeah, okay,
I got to admit.
So you know, then find a functionality of the nictitating membrane, Bob, which is called in humans these plica semilunaris.
Stop the tape. Okay, so we're going to have to continue there on our next episode of Real Science Radio because we're about out of time. But Fred, it's so funny when the entire evolution community agrees with that Dr. Philip Gingrich who discovered Rotocetus, and then his student also, Dr. Hans Thielsen, discovered, was it Pachycetus? And they found some bones, and they drew them like half whale, half land animals. Yeah. And then they
found part of a skull, by the way. That's what they found.
Well, and then they both admit, then they find the rest of the skeleton, and they both admit on video in separate interviews that the ones that they found, oh, yeah, it didn't have flippers. It didn't have a fluke tail. It didn't have a blowhole. All the whale features we put in it, no, it had four legs.
It had none of that.
Right.
And before they discovered all the rest of the, you know, the fossils, the rest of the bones, in a college textbook, the professor who wrote this college textbook said that the sequence of whales is becoming increasingly well known.
Increasingly.
And then it talks about Pachycetus, and it says right in the book, known from a skull.
Right.
I mean, come on, get your baloney detector out. So here
if it was known for a skull, at least it'd have a blowhole.
Yeah.
They didn't have blowholes. They just
they
drew these in.
Yeah, they drew all that stuff in, and all they had was a partial piece of a skull, too.
That's
what they were telling their students.
The filmmaker, Dr. Carl Werner, who got the interviews with both these scientists, the one is the mentor and his student.
Mm-hmm.
They both found these two big whale intermediary fossils. They both faked the drawings because later they admitted, well, you know what? It didn't have the flippers.
Yep.
It had legs like limbs, like a tetrapod. It didn't have the fluke tail like a whale, didn't have a blowhole, but we sort of thought it would have all those things. And so the evolution community, including Dawkins, they put them in the tree on the way to the whale.
Yep.
Now they realize they blew it. They're just land animals, but they still have them there, even though they've corrected the drawings.
Yeah.
They had the animals totally wrong, but they still know they were on the way to the whale.
And they have not yet told Dr. Gary Aguilar.
I guess not. But he could listen to the show we did with Dr. Carl Werner this year, 2014, Leading Whale Fossils Faked. Breaking news. Just go to realscienceradio.com. Just search for Whales Faked. Whale fossils.
And I wonder
faked.
If you send him an email saying, hey, go watch this video, if he'll laugh like he did on the air there and say, oh, we make mistakes, Bob. You think you got all the answers?
Yeah. And Fred, we were just talking about junk DNA. It's not one or two scientists making a mistake. Of course that happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's when the entire evolutionary community
exactly.
thinks 90% of our DNA is junk,
yeah.
and we find out it's almost all
and the
being
Smithsonian
confirmed
and
to be
Washington,
functional.
D.C. still has a thing that says that we're 98 point some odd percent similar to chimps. That's completely wrong.
Right, right. So, okay. Well, thank you, Fred Williams. Can't wait for our live presentation of Real Science Radio.
That's right.
At the Rocky Mount Creation Fellowship on our list of evidence against the Big Bang.
October 10th, Friday night.
Can't wait. That'll be fun. And the next night, the Brady Concert, Be a Voice for Brady with talent from NBC's The Voice. Four singers from The Voice at Be a Voice for Brady. And then our telethon, please help us. Go to realscienceradio.com. Click to buy the flood video or subscribe or shop or donate once or automatic monthly donations. Thank you so much. May God bless you. This is Bob Benyart and Fred Williams for Real Science Radio.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.